Hello and welcome to Science World. Throughout the world, non-native species, such as plants, animals, and insects, cost an estimated $1.4 trillion in damage every year. Today, we'll hear how U.S. scientists are trying to control invasive insect species by pitting these insects against each other. Researchers studying the teeth of our prehistoric ancestors in Africa have learned that they not only used plants for food, but also as medicine. And today, on our one-on-one segment, we'll learn how a new device that was recently implanted into a young quadriplegic man allowed him to move his paralyzed hands and fingers by only using his thoughts. We'll talk with one of the lead researchers of the project that led to the development of this device called the NeuroBridge. These stories and more are coming your way on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. According to the UN, the worldwide cost of damage caused by non-indigenous species is a whopping $1.4 trillion per year. But here on the eastern coast of the United States, scientists have come upon a novel idea in dealing with a particularly destructive beetle. Steve Barragona has the story.
The forests of Maryland are under attack.
See, getting infested. Small larvae over there.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Jian Duan has watched the larvae of the emerald ash borer devastate trees across the United States. On the wooded fringe of a Maryland park, he peels back the bark of one tree to find...
This is loaded with larvae.
The young insects carve twisting galleries under the bark, cutting off the flow of nutrients and killing tens of millions of ash trees. Experts say these Asian invaders probably arrived in a shipment from China. Duan says they are expected to cost an estimated $10 billion in damage through the end of this decade, not to mention the ecological impact.
There is a possibility some species may be completely wiped out by these beetles, and you can imagine the cascading effect by losing a tree species in our native forest.
Ash trees make up 20 to 40% of some northern U.S. forests. The emerald ash borer threatens them and all the creatures that depend on them. When the borer arrived from China in the 1990s, it had no natural enemies here. Now, Duan has brought their enemies over, too.
So, Dave, where's your trees?
Today, Duan and his team are going to turn those enemies loose. They release hundreds of tiny Asian wasps from clear plastic bottles. The wasps will hone in on the eggs laid by adult borers in the cracks of ash tree bark.
The wasps basically crawl into the crack and then they use their antenna to detect where the egg is.
Then they lay their own eggs inside the borer's egg. The young wasps steal the developing borer's food. They live, the borer dies. In Asia, Duan says, these wasps help keep the borer's population in check.
That's kind of like we re-established the relationship between the borer, the Amdash borer, with its natural enemies.
Wasps are used successfully to control cassava mealybugs in Africa and many other invasive pests. But Duan knows fighting an invasive insect with another import can be risky. It could become invasive too. The wasps are raised in a red-lit quarantine lab while they're tested. The red lights subdue escapees, and lab workers wear disposable outerwear to stop any hitchhikers from getting out. Duan will only release picky eaters, wasps that would much rather attack an emerald ash borer than a native insect. The wasps released today pass the tests, but they have a big job ahead of them.
You have to take a long term. It's because think about how many Amdash borer are out in the U.S. and how many wasps we released. We released, 10,000 wasps. It's really nothing, a drop in the ocean, similar.
Now, Duan and his team will watch and wait to see if the wasps can return some balance to an ecosystem at risk. Steve Barragona, VOA News, La Plata, Maryland.
U.S. scientists have created what they describe as a biological pacemaker to keep the heart beating normally. As Jessica Berman reports, they are experimenting with a harmless virus to treat patients with heart rhythm disorders.
Currently, surgeons implant electronic pacemakers to electrically stimulate the hearts of patients with heart block. These types of heart rhythm disorders cause the heart to beat slowly, can cause lightheadedness, fatigue, fainting, and in the worst cases, sudden death. But there can be problems with pacemakers. Sometimes they malfunction. Also, patients occasionally develop an infection requiring the removal of the pacemaker for 6 to 8 weeks of antibiotic treatment. And occasionally fetuses have heart block, which can result in stillbirth. Researchers at Cedars-Sinai Heart Institute in Los Angeles, California, have developed a biological therapy that may someday replace pacemakers. Scientists created a natural pacemaker in experiments with pigs with a malfunctioning sinoatrial node, which regulates the heartbeat. They engineered a harmless virus to carry a gene called TBX18, then put it into a part of the heart the size of a peppercorn. Lead researcher Eduardo Marban is director of the Cedars-Sinai Heart Institute.
The TBX18 gene converts ordinary heart cells, of which there are billions in the human heart, into specialized sinoatrial node cells, which number only in the thousands. In essence, we create a new sinoatrial node in a part of the heart that ordinarily spreads the impulse but does not originate it.
TBX18 plays a brief role in the development of the sinoatrial node in developing fetuses. The TBX18 infusion regulated the pig's heartbeats like a functioning sinoatrial node. The treatment lasted for 2 weeks, the length of the study. In the United States, an estimated 300,000 heart patients receive pacemakers every year. About 2% of them develop infections. Researchers are initially targeting these individuals to receive the gene therapy. Investigators are planning human clinical trials. They eventually hope their work, which has been 20 years in the making, leads to a biological treatment for heart rhythm irregularities. Nikhil Munshi is a cardiologist at University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Most of the time, Munshi says pacemakers work well and will probably continue to be the first-line treatment for heart block. But he says having an alternative to the electronic device would be nice.
In theory, at least, I think a strategy in which we can sort of re-engineer nature may prove beneficial long-term over electronic pacemakers, although electronic pacemakers are exceptionally helpful in treating many of these patients.
Munshi wrote an accompanying perspectives piece in the journal Science Translational Medicine, where cardiologists from Cedars-Sinai Heart Institute report their work creating a biological pacemaker. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Today on our Science World Quick Quiz, we mark the 45th anniversary of the first moon landing. Back on July 20th, 1969, Apollo 11 commander Neil Armstrong stepped off the ladder attached to the mission's lunar lander Eagle and set his left foot on the moon's surface, making him the first human to do so. As Armstrong stepped onto the moon, he spoke those immortal words.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Right after speaking the historic words, Commander Armstrong then went on to make remarks about the appearance of the lunar surface, saying that it looked like a particular location on Earth. What we'd like to know today is, what location did he say it looked like? Was it A, the high desert of the United States, B, Antarctica, or C, the Sahara Desert in Africa? Good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
A new United Nations report warns our privacy is being threatened by digital surveillance. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The report warns digital snooping is increasing and occurring in countries all over the world. It says the incidence may be greater in governments equipped with better technology, but it fears oversight of digital surveillance programs in most countries is inadequate and therefore open to abuse. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay says states must show their surveillance programs are being used for legitimate law enforcement or intelligence purposes. She says it is up to the government officials to prove these programs do not arbitrarily or unlawfully gather information on people. She tells VOA states have an obligation to balance their need for security with their need to protect people's right to privacy.
I, of course, support the efforts made in the United States and other countries to safeguard all of us from acts of terrorism. After all, states have an obligation to protect all their citizens against the harm of terrorism. On the other hand, what are the checks and balances? What kind of safeguards should be in place? And how should states be encouraged to update their laws and so on to keep pace with these developments?
The report notes strong evidence of governments' growing reliance on the private sector to conduct and facilitate digital surveillance. Pillay says she is disturbed by the methods governments are using to collect metadata on their own citizens as well as on foreigners.
Some governments have reportedly threatened to ban services of telecommunications companies unless given direct access to communication traffic. Others have tapped fiber optic cables for surveillance purposes or required companies systematically to disclose bulk information on customers and employees. Some have used communication surveillance to target political opposition or dissidents.
Pillay warns that companies which supply data to a state in violation of human rights law risk being complicit or involved with human rights abuses. The High Commissioner says she believes it is important to protect so-called whistleblowers, people who disclose human rights violations. She refuses to say whether intelligence analyst Edward Snowden should be pardoned for having revealed the mass surveillance program being used by the NSA, the United States National Security Agency. The UN report raises concerns about surveillance programs based on racial profiling or which target certain ethnic or religious groups. It says such practices violate international human rights law. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Long before the development of agriculture, our prehistoric ancestors had a good knowledge of plants, not just for food, but for medicine. Researchers found evidence of this by studying some ancient teeth found in Central Sudan. Joe DiCapua reports.
Dental hygiene has become an important part of modern-day healthcare, and many millions of dollars are spent every year to keep teeth and gums healthy. One of the things dentists warn their patients about is dental calculus, or tartar, a very hard form of plaque that forms around teeth. It may take a lot of scraping or the use of ultrasonic tools to remove it. That type of plaque has given researchers an insight into people who lived thousands of years ago along the White Nile at Al-Khadey. It's about 25 kilometers south of Omdurman. Karen Hardy is the lead author of the study, published in PLOS One. She and her colleagues went to the site to analyze the compounds clinging to the ancient teeth.
We were hoping for evidence of ancient diet, particularly evidence of the use of plants in ancient diet before agriculture developed. That's something that is very difficult to get hold of. It's very difficult to find.
But they did find it, and the tartar told the tale. The people of Al-Khadey were well aware of the use of plants thousands of years before agriculture arrived on the scene in 4500 BC, and long after.
We found evidence of plants. We could see the physical evidence in the form of the microfossils on microscope slides, and we also got chemical compounds that pointed, in this case specifically, to this plant, purple nutsedge, right through the sequence. In ancient Egypt, it was used as a component of perfume, it was used in water purification, and it also has a lot of medicinal uses that have been recorded by the ancient Greeks and the ancient Egyptians.
It's believed purple nut sedge may have had the ability to inhibit the growth of Streptococcus mutans. It's bacteria that help cause tooth decay, and its effectiveness appears to be borne out in many ancient teeth which showed few cavities. The findings also shed light on their prehistoric diet and dispel some misconceptions.
Up to the present, the evidence has not been there for plants. There has been a strong focus on the use of meat products, simply because that is what is found. It's found in evidence for animal bones spread across sites, strong evidence of protein, and there simply has not been the evidence there for the plants. Now, hopefully, with this kind of study that we're doing, we're going to be able to start getting closer to identifying some of the plant-based things that people ate, because, of course, they really had to eat plants. You can't survive on protein alone.
Professor Hardy and her colleagues are now working on many different archaeological sites with varying time periods. She says they may discover the use of other plants by ancient people long since forgotten. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. After speaking those historic first words from the surface of the moon, that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, Commander Neil Armstrong then went on to describe the appearance of the lunar surface as something familiar back here on Earth. To what was Armstrong referring? Was it A, the high desert of the United States, B, Antarctica, or C, the Sahara Desert in Africa? The answer is A, the high desert of the United States.
It has a stark beauty all its own. It's like much of the high desert of the United States. It's different, but it's very pretty out here.
Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Quadriplegics, by definition, aren't able to use their arms or legs due to accident or disease. But recently, a 23-year-old quadriplegic from the U.S. state of Ohio was able to do something he hasn't been able to do for a long time, move his fingers and his hands. With a new surgically implanted device called the NeuroBridge, the young man was able to do what many had long thought would be impossible just by using his own thoughts. The device is the result of a partnership between the Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center and the Battelle Memorial Institute. Chad Booten, a research leader at Battelle, joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about the NeuroBridge and the hope it's giving those who can't move their limbs due to severe spinal cord injuries. This new device, NeuroBridge, what is it and what does it do?
Okay, the NeuroBridge system and technology is a way to take signals from the brain and actually specifically from neurons in the brain and route them around an injury such as a spinal cord injury and then relink those signals to the muscles of someone who's paralyzed. And the goal is to allow that person to be able to regain movement in the affected limb.
As you mentioned, the device bypasses the spinal cord and it sends signals from the brain to the actual muscles. Now, what led to this particular approach?
Well, so we had been working on the problem of decoding brain signals in folks that are paralyzed going back almost 10 years. And we thought, you know, we had some great success in working with other researchers in the area in doing things like controlling cursors on a computer and devices. But we thought we should be able to take the next step and allow someone who's disabled actually regain movement in a limb that is paralyzed. And so we started to develop the system and the technology a few years ago to really take it to that next level.
So what is the patient that had the device implanted able to do now that he wasn't able to do before the implant?
The patient has been able to think about different wrist and hand movements and even finger movements, and he is able to actually open and close his hand. And we've also been able to have him hold an object and actually move that object and then let go of that object.
How does he do that?
Well, so it starts with training, and we call it basically virtual. We have a virtual hand on the screen, and he looks at that hand and thinks about different movements. And then the hand, over time, starts to move in response to his brain activity. So we have developed special mathematical methods and software, or as we call algorithms, that learn his brain activity over time and then adapt and improve that feedback on the virtual hand on the screen. So the software gets better, the algorithms get better, and then Ian, or our patient, is able to get better over time as well and improve the performance.
So in other words, you're going from a visual cue, so you're taking input from the eye into the brain and making him think about moving his hand. So that's quite a bit of a jump.
Yes, yes it is. And we've learned how to adapt and improve the understanding of the brain activity, the language of the neurons, if you will. But we've also started to emulate the human spinal cord. So the spinal cord is not just a simple conduit of signals from the brain to the muscles. The spinal cord actually helps coordinate movements of the body. And if you think about walking, for example, your spinal cord is doing a tremendous amount of computation as you walk, and that's to allow your brain to think about other things. And so we're trying to figure out how to actually emulate those functions of the spinal cord since we've bypassed it now with the NeuroBridge technology.
So please tell us what you and your team have learned since fitting the device on this young man.
We've learned a tremendous amount from a technical or technology standpoint, and we have learned how brain activity will change as someone, we're starting to learn how the brain activity will change as someone who's paralyzed begins to move again under their own thought patterns and their own control. Because this is really new, we're entering a new area, we're just learning a tremendous amount from that. And then really on a personal note, we've learned a tremendous amount from Ian, our patient, our first patient. He's just an amazing young man, and he has taught us a lot about how to really, move through life and deal with adversity. And he's done a tremendous job in the study, and his attitude and his focus and his overall enthusiasm is tremendous.
And finally, Chad, is the NeuroBridge a work that is still in progress, or has it been developed to where it's close to being released commercially?
Well, no, it's still under development. We are definitely in early stages as we continue to learn more. We will also need to refine the technology and develop further aspects to it over time. And then, of course, whenever you try to commercialize a medical technology, it does require additional studies and quite a bit of clinical data as well. So we don't know yet how long that will take, but we're certainly going to keep moving forward. And I want to mention this has been a tremendous effort from a large team here at Battelle, but also with our partners at Ohio State. They've been just wonderful to work with as well on this, and we're hoping to really move forward and strengthen our collaborations.
That was Chad Booten, a research leader at Battelle in Columbus, Ohio. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the Internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.